Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Shortly before dawn on Saturday, Russia's richest man was taken at gunpoint from his plane as it refueled on a Siberian runway. Mega oil baron Mikhail Khodorkovsky was charged with fraud and tax evasion. But that's just the tip of this iceberg. His arrest is the latest strike in a profound struggle between Russian factions over Russia's future, between big money oligarchy and former KGB head, now hard-nosed president Vladimir Putin. Tonight on Point, big money versus big Putin and the future of Russia. We begin in Moscow with a closer look at the jailed Russian multi-billionaire at the center of the controversy. Scott Peterson is Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked him what made Mikhail Khodorkovsky a target.
Well, he is one of the few men known as oligarchs who made vast wealth in the 1990s during the privatization of the assets of the Soviet Union in the first years of the new Russia. And a lot of these men have tried their hand in politics. Some of them have been forced out by the Kremlin in the 1990s with President Boris Yeltsin. They had a very close and tidy relationship, basically, although, of course, many people knew that they had engaged in very serious business malpractices, shall we say, and rigging various deals in order to get as wealthy as they have. In this case, we have an oligarch who not only has decided that he would stay in politics by backing two opposition parties, but he also is the wealthiest man in Russia, worth $8 billion. He's even believed to have had presidential ambitions for the year 2008. And there is a group within the Kremlin who are close to President Putin who seem to be moving to control these kind of businessmen and these kind of business ambitions.
But why such a dramatic move, and why now? Seized by masked government gunmen on his plane in Siberia, was it even a legal seizure? Where is he now, and why would Putin have felt the need to move so dramatically?
Well, these are questions that really aren't yet clear, in fact. And part of it, some people even argue that President Putin himself didn't order this, but that basically he said, look into getting some kind of control back over Yukos, which is the largest oil company in Russia. It has vast holdings. It exports more oil, in fact, per day than Kuwait does. So we are talking a very, very large company. But in the effort to regain control, some people argued that some of the security services and others took too strong a hand, that the general prosecutor was basically switching back to the old Soviet, even Stalinist ways, as a matter of fact. On the other hand, you've got some analysts who are arguing that Putin himself, by just a few days ago declaring that as far as he was concerned, this looked like it was a lawful arrest, the prosecutors were simply following the law. Some analysts are saying that even this was kind of a Stalinist argument, since the vast majority of people here believe that there were pure politics behind it.
Technically, he's been charged with fraud and tax evasion. He's been detained. Scott, can you share with us the drumbeat of events that have followed, the repercussions since that arrest on Saturday?
Well, I think that the aftermath is something that the Kremlin itself has been shocked by, in the sense that almost every single newspaper has been very critical. Almost all analysts have been critical. And people have been critical for different reasons. On a political level, some people say this is blatant manipulation by the Kremlin, by hawks within the Kremlin who are trying to assert their authority within the Kremlin and in the Russian government. This is a blatant attempt by them to manipulate politics on the eve of a parliamentary election that we are having in early December here. And then, of course, we also have presidential elections here next March. So a lot of people see some kind of manipulations going on in that respect. And then on the other hand, we also have analysts who are arguing that, in fact, really the main repercussions are for economic reasons. In other words, what the Kremlin is trying to do is reassert authority in a very kind of old and Soviet way over some of these huge companies that really rule the roost in modern Russia's economy.
The conflict seems to go deep. Today we have word that Alexander Voloshin, the chief of staff of Vladimir Putin himself, a big, powerful backroom figure, has reportedly resigned. What's that split about?
This is something that has been in the mix for many, many months. This has been the longest presidential chief of staff that anyone can remember, the longest serving, the longest surviving, I should say. This is a man who was basically instrumental during the later Yeltsin years, and then also in helping to bring President Putin to power. Now, he is also a key player in one faction in the Kremlin that is called the Family. These are the ones who are close to the oligarchs, like those who've been arrested, like other ambitious and incredibly rich Russians who really became wealthy during the 1990s. All of these people have formed in their influential groups a faction called the Family, and what we are seeing, according to some analysts, is a face-off between them and the new group that came in with President Putin 3 years ago of former KGB and other associates of the president who now feel that they want to get their hands on a slice of the pie.
So is there a fundamental conflict here now then between the kind of oligarch realm and the government KGB elite?
Well, this is exactly how some people are casting it. Of course, while you're looking at that political tug of war that's going on the other side, you've got regular businessmen who are deciding whether or not Russia is a worthwhile place to invest. And what they see is a case where the most powerful businessman in all of Russia has been arrested, as you said earlier, by masked men on his plane while he's on the tarmac in Siberia, which means who possibly can conduct business here in a way that is going to be transparent, in a way that is also going to be secure in terms of getting and making your profits and in terms of the rule of law. So these are the questions that really are on the minds of everyone in Russia today.
But then in terms of politics, I mean, nobody comes with exactly clean hands here. As you said, the oligarchs made their money in some fairly dubious ways. Is it clear which faction is the more favorably disposed toward democracy?
Well, this is not clear at all, in fact, although it's often believed that the faction that was put together in the 1990s, the Yeltsin, the Family group, and the oligarchs, that they are more liberal-minded. Democracy is probably not a word that they would use, but it's certainly not one that you would apply to the closer Putin associates either, who are really kind of in this sense seen as hawks and in many respects looking to, as some analysts say, trying to reestablish authority. Some even talk about the possibility of some of these privatization schemes of the 1990s being undone and unraveled. And if that kind of thing happens, then I think that we will see some very serious questions raised by business people here in wondering whether or not Russia is a worthwhile investment anymore.
Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson is Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with us earlier from Moscow. When Russian President Vladimir Putin visited Camp David a month ago, George Bush praised Putin's Russia as a country where, quote, democracy and freedom and the rule of law thrive. But it was raw power on display in the arrest of Russia's wealthiest man last weekend. Putin's gunpoint politics has business leaders and foreign investors rethinking Russia, and everyone wondering where the country is headed. With everything going on in the world, have you kept track at all of Russia? What are your instincts about who wears the white hat here, Putin or the oligarchs? Between oligarch money and the sons of the KGB, is there room for democracy in Moscow? Should the West, should Washington be pressuring Putin? And for what? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Fiona Hill, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the forthcoming book, The Siberian Curse. Good evening and welcome, Fiona Hill.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Also joining us from Washington tonight is Anders Aslan, director of the Russian and Eurasian Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Good evening and welcome, Anders Aslan.
Good evening. Nice to be here.
I'm glad to have you both with us. There's a lot to sort out here. I have to say it's completely confusing. Fiona Hill, to you first, if I may. What's going on in this power play between, I don't know, you tell me, the Kremlin and Russia's richest man? Is this a strike for democracy, constraining oligarch power? Or is this a Stalinist kind of Kremlin power play, even as some are saying, the beginning of the rollback of democratic gains since the Berlin Wall fell?
Well, I think the one thing that we can certainly say is that this is not a strike for democracy. I think certainly in terms of all the other interpretations that Scott Peterson just laid out for us,
yeah,
I think there lies the root of the problem. The situation in Moscow right now is so unclear. There's so much of a lack of transparency that it's open to all kinds of interpretations. We've got a whole series of mixed signals here. And Hodorkovsky himself was here in Washington just a couple of weeks ago. In fact, Anders was his host at the Carnegie Endowment. And Hodorkovsky himself, during this presentation that he gave to us, said he wasn't sure what the signals were that he was being sent. He said he thought he was reading them correctly. This is in some of the action that's already been taken against UCOS, that questions are being raised about UCOS activities, some of his other colleagues already being arrested.
And another big shareholder arrested in, what, June or July, in a series of investigations there. Anders Aslan, what about it? This man, the richest in Russia, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, he was supposed to be the model of the transparent businessman, the oligarch who made that metamorphosis from robber baron to corporate leader, to philanthropist, to transparent global business dealer.
Yeah, I presume that was his problem. I think that what we are seeing now in Russia is a very clear authoritarian drive in small steps. Khodorkovsky is the third oligarch who has been put into serious legal trouble. A fourth major oligarch has quietly sold out in Russia and emigrated, and he was the person who knew President Putin the best. One leading television station after the other has been put under state and Kremlin control. Virtually each regional election now of a regional governor is faked in one way or the other, mostly because the leading candidate or one of the leading candidates is disqualified on flimsy grounds in the last minute. This is politics. It's not economics.
But the oligarchs themselves come out of some pretty shady background, pretty hard-nosed business, and some would say half-legitimized ripoff of the country. Putin seemed to have a deal with them, Anders Aslan, that you can have your business and your money, but stay out of politics. Is it healthy for an emerging Russian democracy to have these mega multi-billionaires in the middle of things when so many people are poor and don't have any kind of economic power?
In 1900, the U.S. had 22 billionaires in the current currency values. Mm-hmm. Russia has 17 billionaires right now. And I think that the situations are comparable. Big businessmen are better than the KGB. Would you have preferred a U.S. KGB to the American robber barons 100 years ago?
No, thank you.
I don't think so.
No, I wouldn't. And America made it through that. Fiona Hill, what about it then? Anders is quite clear in saying this is more than a chipping away at democracy. This is an organized kind of squashing. Is that how you see it?
Well, it's certainly an organized squashing. I think there's no question about it. But actually, just in the way, Tom, that you formulated the question to Anders, really spells out why this is actually so beneficial for certain people in the Kremlin, including President Putin right now.
What do you mean by that?
You basically laid out the question. I mean, is it healthy for Russia to have these big billionaires when your implication being so many people are having such a difficult time in the transition? And as you said at the beginning of the program, here we are. We're only a few weeks out from an election, a parliamentary election, the Russian Duma election, December 7th. We have a presidential election next year. Mm-hmm. And simple slogans, which in this case would be down with the oligarchs, play very well to an electorate who is indeed feeling very dissatisfied with the transition. Most people, the man on the street, the woman on the street, the pensioner on the street, won't see this as an attack against democracy. In fact, they'll see this as a strike for social justice carried out by Putin, who's presented himself as a man of the people and who, no matter what he has done over the last several years, including launching a catastrophic war in Chechnya, has retained rather massive popularity. I mean, he's still his ratings, he's still around 70%. And this plays extremely well to the crowd. This is populist politics.
So the old Russian instinct to pull down the big guy, the rich guys, is still there. But is the line that Putin will pull out of that that's so popular, is it entirely wrong? Is it entirely misleading, Fiona Hill?
Well, it is misleading in many respects, precisely because of what Anders has said. I mean, what we're going to do now is start to pull down everyone after Hodorkovsky, mm-hmm. we're really going to be in something of a mess. Because although one can really raise questions about how the privatization campaign in the early 1990s was carried out, the question is, if you're starting again, who now gets a piece of this pie? I mean, is this all about just simply a redistribution of resources to someone else? I mean, all these questions get raised, and certainly none of it points in the direction of a transparent and fair process.
Doesn't sound good. Fiona Hill, Anders Aslan, please stand by. We're talking tonight about an oligarch's imprisonment and big money versus big Putin in Russia. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What do your instincts tell you about who wears what hat here? Putin have the white hat? Do the oligarchs? And is this the rebirth of the Russian old guard stamping out a potential political challenger or putting money in its place? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about an oligarch's imprisonment. The richest man in Russia is in jail. We're looking at big money, big Putin, Russia's future. My guests tonight are Fiona Hill with the Brookings Institution in Washington and Anders Aslan at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. You can join the conversation as well. Do you fear a return to KGB-style politics in Russia? Are we already there? Maybe even an imperial Russia reemerging? And should the West, should Washington be pressuring Vladimir Putin for Khodorkovsky's release for the rule of law? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anders Aslan, what did Mikhail Khodorkovsky have to say when he visited you and your group in Washington just a few weeks ago?
Well, taking on the political point, he essentially said that Russian businessmen are spending a lot of money on politics, and they do it for two purposes. One is lobbyism, which is being undertaken all over the world. That is being done by the companies in their interest. And the problem in Russia is only that it's not regulated by law as it should be. And the other is a big businessman personally who spend money on political parties and other organizations. And this he considered civil society activity that should be perceived as legitimate.
And Fiona Hill, what do we know about how active Mikhail Khodorkovsky was in politics? How much money was he funneling into? Does he represent a real challenge to Vladimir Putin?
Well, I think the area where he represented the biggest challenge was, in fact, in the sector in which he has made all of his money. If we look at Russia today, yes, oil and gas are the big business in Russia. This is the major source of government revenue through taxation of this sector. It's also one of the most important features in Russian domestic politics because, of course, so many people out across Russia are very dependent on low-cost oil and gas for heating and electricity and the rest of it. And it's also been extraordinarily important on the international stage. I mean, just as you said at the very beginning of the program, Russia is a major world oil supplier. In fact, it competes regularly with Saudi Arabia as being the number one producer and exporter. So this is an area where Russia can really compete at an international level economically, whereas in many other fields it certainly cannot. And so the mere fact that Mikhail Khodorkovsky has become so important in oil and gas, he has amassed so much money, and that he's playing on the international stage as well as the domestic stage, I think really increased his position. So I don't think it was so much that he was giving money to individual political parties, but he's been giving money not just inside Russia to orphans and a whole variety of good charitable works and non-governmental organizations. He's even been giving money to the U.S. Library of Congress.
We'll look more at his political ambitions, but what about just on the oil front? I mean, he built the fourth largest oil company in the world, far and away the biggest oil and gas company in Russia. He was negotiating to perhaps sell a big share of it to ExxonMobil or to Chevron, Texaco. Is there a kind of nationalizing impulse at work here? Could the Kremlin have been afraid of foreign ownership of a big chunk of its big oil company?
Well, to some degree, I mean, you touched upon it there. You said he built it. I think many people in the Kremlin and many people in the rest of the energy sector would say, no, he didn't build it. He acquired it through the privatization program in the early 1990s. This, you know, for many people in the Kremlin and for many people in the rather state-dominated sector of the energy industry, is the state's asset. This was built up under the Soviet Union. This was built up by real oil men. Mm-hmm. There are many people in the energy industry who see Khodorkovsky as an arrivist, someone who kind of came in very early with no background in the sector. And in fact, he's talked quite openly, in fact, recently in interviews just a few weeks ago, of that when he gets to age 45, he sees himself as retiring from the energy business and moving on to other things. And by that, he's, you know, mentioned his philanthropic activities and many other things. And we've seen people like Khodorkovsky. There's another oligarch, Roman Abramovich, who Was also the head of Sibneft, which has just undergone a merger with Yukos, who recently bought the Chelsea soccer team in England. And this has been touted, again, as a kind of an example of what these new oligarchs are up to. You know, they're not being responsible with their disposition of the assets. So I think there was some feelings in different circles, not just in the Kremlin, but in elsewhere, that Hodorkovsky thought that this was indeed his to dispose of. And in fact, he said precisely that at Anders' event, when he was asked, you know, what did he think of people like Roman Abramovich, in fact, purchasing the Chelsea soccer team? He said, look, people in Russia have got to get used to people, he didn't say just like me, but basically people spending their money as they see fit. And I'm sure that that got hackles up in many quarters in Moscow.
Ed's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Ed, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
There's a connection I think that needs to be made. As one of the people that actually worked in the former Soviet Union while privatization was going on, many of us saw this entire privatization process as a complete ripoff to most of the folks out there. The oligarchs themselves got great state assets at pennies on the dollar,
right,
if anything else, and the great majority of people got absolutely nothing from it. And so net-net, if you look at the Chinese model of marketization, it's much more stable, much stronger government, and the government can kind of help, at least to a certain degree, help people kind of walk through this entire market.
I mean, the Chinese
process.
Model being where not everything is given out and doesn't, not everything ends up in the hands of a few oligarchs.
Correct. And actually, to a degree, the society doesn't kind of fragment and completely fall apart.
So are you saying, Ed, tangentially, that it was time for Putin to rein in Mikhail Khodorkovsky?
Well, there's certainly a case to be made for saying, look, these are people's assets, and maybe it's time to actually refigure out how the distribution happened. There's certainly a case to be made for that. There's certainly no great adoration to go back to Stalinist pogroms and all the rest of that kind of stuff. But also, let's face it, right now, if you look at average lifespan and all that kind of stuff for Soviet people, it is certainly much less than it was 15 years ago.
Boy, it's easy to be sympathetic to that line of analysis, and yet we're hearing from our guest tonight that Putin is simply using that to put the brakes on a man who might have helped fuel an engine of democracy. But let us pick it up. And Ed, thanks for your call. I want to welcome into our conversation now Marshall Goldman, joining us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's professor emeritus of Russian economics at Wellesley College, author of The Piratization of Russia, Russian Reform Goes Awry. Good evening and welcome, Marshall Goldman.
Thanks very much.
You heard the observation just made there by our call, Ed, saying, look, these oligarchs benefited from a windfall of essentially public assets that came into their private hands, and feeling that maybe Putin's right to pull back on that. On the other hand, how do you develop a democracy if you don't let powerful people within the country begin to organize around different poles of power?
Well, that's exactly the dilemma. But it seems to me that there are better ways of getting at it than what sending in masked men with submachine guns on a plane and arresting basically the whole hierarchy of a company that has to be unsettling for anybody else who's interested in moving in there. So there are other things you can do. For example, you could say we're going to declare an amnesty to the oligarchs and we're going to ask you to pay up what you presumably should have paid when you acquired those properties. And if you do pay up and we can reach some kind of agreement, just like a tax amnesty, or maybe settle for half or something, three quarters.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, then you can have a statute of limitations. We'll be home free.
So then in that case, Mikhail Khodorkovsky might be worth $2 billion or $4 billion instead of $8 billion, but still a rich man, and the Russians would have some of their assets back.
Absolutely. And the same thing all the way down the line. Some have said give him a statute of limitations right away, and I don't think that would fly politically. That's asking for trouble. But you've got to get them to cough up, and I would suspect that some already have done that. For Man Potanin has kicked in $200 million or so, and that would be a much better way to do it.
But how do you interpret what's actually going on, Marshall, with Vladimir Putin? Excuse me. Is this an honest effort to kind of put his thumb and even on the scales and even them, or is this just a way of pushing away a potential political opponent?
Well, in addition to what Fiona and Anders have said, I think there's some other issues here. I think there's a genuine concern amongst the people who are now getting increased strength around Putin, former members of the KGB, that the foreign community is insinuating its way in and taking over, if not careful, all the oil fields and many of the gas fields. And so there's a strong element here of nationalism, and you can get that a lot in some of the conversations the KGB people have been recorded as saying. So there are some legitimate concerns here, but while you want to say that Khodorkovsky's record is probably one of the worst finaglers, one of the worst deceivers and scammers until he found religion, as it were, and decided to become transparent in mm-hmm. the late 90s. Mm-hmm. So he deserves, in some sense, but the people who are attacking him certainly don't deserve our sympathy either. In a sense, they're made for each other. They each deserve each other, and it's a tragedy to see it happen.
They may deserve each other, but what a bad path. Anders Asland, please.
Yeah, sorry if I may jump in. Marshall, you have just published a book that deals with one topic. It is how the privatization was undertaken in Russia.
Right.
Where it is a full-scale attack on the oligarchs. You are with Putin on this one.
No, no.
When I have argued for amnesty, exactly what you said now, I'm happy to hear that.
Oh, no,
previously,
Anders,
you have attacked me for it.
Yes, Anders, the difference is, you see, I think that amnesty can only come if there is the payment of back monies. You see, I said exactly, I repeated myself here, that giving them a statute of limitations and amnesty without recapturing the rent, without recapturing that, would be scandalous and would be politically non-viable. So, and that's why I think it's wrong. But
Marshall Goldman, even in that little exchange, we hear that even among the Russia watchers, there's a kind of a daggers out level of disagreement about what's going on here.
Absolutely, and Anders and I go at it all the time, because I think what the biggest problem is right now is because that the reforms were carried out in a flawed way. They've got a false bottom now, and anybody can fall through it, and Putin tomorrow can pick on one of the other oligarchs, or Putin's successor can do it, and you're never going to have stability, and you're never going to have foreign investment or domestic investment of the sort that you need until you can work that out. And therefore, that's why I'm saying they've got to go back and redress the issue. And these oligarchs who have really taken what were state assets and claimed them as their own for a pittance, that's simply not going to go. Some people say, well,
this is renationalization. If you ask people to pay more for the assets that they have got, then you are renationalizing assets.
Now, Anders, let me ask you just on that point. Are you saying the problem with that is what exactly? That it would scare away foreign investment, that it takes away the rule of law and guarantees of private property, or that it's simply wrong? I mean, everybody knows they paid a pittance for these enormous assets.
To begin with, many of the Russian oligarchs have actually bought the assets in a second round. If you take most of the metals companies and the coal companies that are now very successful, they are bought in the second round. And what is then different if they have bought them at rock bottom prices that have been the market prices? The oligarchs are defending themselves that these companies that they were taking over were companies that were totally criminalized. Hundreds of millions of dollars were stolen by the managers in each of the major oil companies, and they have now been turned around.
Fiona Hill, I want to bring you in here, if I may, Fiona Hill, and ask you this. Is there a middle ground here? If you're looking at Russia, do you have to be either for Putin or for the oligarchs? Is there a middle ground? Is there a democratic ground, or is that just missing?
Well, I think there is a middle ground. The question is, of course, where to look for it. I mean, actually, the significant point of the exchange here between Marshall and Anders, and as you'll have noted what Anders just said here, mm-hmm. is we're talking about the commanding heights, in a way, of the Russian economy.
We sure are.
And unfortunately for Russia, the economy is still quite thin, although the Russian economy is performing extremely well in oil and gas and commodities. I mean, its whole manufacturing industry is still relatively shaky. You still have 48% of manufacturing industries in Russia as loss makers. I mean, these are, again, some of the old assets left over from the Soviet Union. It's been very hard to build up new business, although you've had a lot of growth in the service sector mm-hmm. and a lot of growth in new light manufacturing industry, and especially a lot of growth in Moscow itself. Moscow has really become a motor for economic growth. And this is not what we're talking about. I mean, these new sectors, the light industry, the new service sector that we're seeing in Moscow,
yeah.
I don't think you've got the same kinds of disagreements here. I mean, what you're really talking about is what are the prizes that people inherited from the Soviet Union. And
but
this
they're
is
so
where most
big
the
that the power embedded in them
that's
overshadows the
that's
other.
Right. That's exactly the problem. That's because that's the, in fact, the danger inherent in the Russian economy right now. It's still over-dependent at this stage, 10 years out, on the big business of energy, metals, and other commodities.
The super commanding heights. Marshall Goldman, I hear you there.
Yes, I'm still here. The one thing I say is an example of what even the second round was still a theft. For example, Khodorkovsky paid $300 million for what today is worth $8 billion. So that's an example of what I say should be redressed. And until you can do that, You're not going to have people comfortable with investment. They may indeed come into the oil sector because there's no place else to go. But for the manufacturers, it's just too unsettling. And if you know, Russian investment and foreign direct investment right now is a pittance, even though it's increased a little bit. But capital is flowing out again after all these arrests.
Yeah, we've got that argument. I don't know if we'll settle it tonight. I want to bring our callers in. 1-800-423-8255. Doug is calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I got a question.
Yeah.
Why is it that all of these oligarchs are overwhelmingly Jewish and several of them have Israeli citizenship? There seems to be something kind of shaky going on here. Perhaps your guest could tell me what it is.
Are you suggesting Russian anti-Semitism? Doug, are you there?
That's what people always say. If you state the obvious, it's anti-Semitism. But it is obvious these people are all Jews. You look at Kaczynski, you look at Friedman, you look at Abramovich, you look at Berezovsky.
We got it.
And you look at Lebedev, the deputy. He's Jewish.
This is the other Yukos man. Just arrested. Let us pick it up. And thanks for your call, Doug. Anders Eisland, what about it? I'm reading here from a Washington Post op-ed piece just from a few days ago by Bruce Jackson. He says, for those who have not kept up with their Russian, he says, oligarch is a term of art for rich Jews. He said, since Putin was elected president in 2000, every major figure exiled or arrested for financial crimes has been Jewish. Is this anti-Semitism going on or what?
Actually, Khodorkovsky was asked that question at our seminar at Carnegie earlier
in
October.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I do not think that anti-Semitism is a big problem in Russia.
I think
that there is a certain aspect of it, but you also have a number of big businessmen, Putanin, Deripaska, Melnichenko, who are not Jewish. You can say that as time has passed by, the number of top businessmen has increased. But of course, if you look back, all the oligarchs virtually are today engineers from the best engineering schools in Moscow. And you had a lot of Jews going to these schools. So this is the kind of environment that has taken over. You have a similar concentration of Jews in arts, as indeed there are considerable concentrations of different nationalities or ethnic groups in different professions in most countries, including the U.S.
Marshall Goldman, what do you think? Just ambitious Jews or anti-Semitism?
I don't disagree entirely with Anders. I think there is something. Another oligarch who's not Jewish, of course, is the head of Lukoil, Oleg Perov.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what is happening is that the people who are leading the attack on the oligarchs are great Russians and members of the KGB, and it's clear in some of the conversations that have been wiretapped that they want that we're going to show. One of them put it: we're going to show who's master of the forest. And the implication here, and certainly in some of the candidates who are running for office, are noted anti-Semites. So there is an element here, but it is also true that these a disproportionate number of these people are Jewish and therefore subject to attack.
Marshall Goldman, Anders Eisland, Fiona Hill, stand by. We're to come back and look at exactly where all this is headed. We're looking at the imprisonment of Russia's richest man, big money versus big Putin in Russia. You can join the conversation with everything going on in the world. Have you kept track of Russia, and is this the rebirth of the Russian old guard stamping out a potential political challenger? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about an oligarch's imprisonment and big money versus big Putin in Russia. My guests tonight are Fiona Hill. She's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She's published extensively on Russia's democratization, security, and economic transition. Her forthcoming book is The Siberian Curse, How Communist Planners Left Russia Out in the Cold. Also from Washington, Anders Eisland, director of the Russian and Eurasian Program and senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. And with us from Cambridge, Massachusetts, Marshall Goldman, professor emeritus of Russian Economics at Wellesley College, Associate Director of Russian Studies at Harvard, and author of The Piratization of Russia, Russian Reform Goes Awry. You can join this conversation as well. If you were Vladimir Putin, would you want to see Russia's biggest oil company sold to Exxon? And between oligarch money and the sons of the KGB, is there room for democracy in Russia? What should the message of the West of Washington be to Russia now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Actually, I have a brief comment. I think the big problem in Russia is tax evasion. And I have friends who earn, let's say, $3,000 a month, but they get paid under the table because companies do not want to pay taxes. They do not want to pay people money that is transparent. And I think that prevents a large number of industries from blossoming, such as credit industry and many other industries.
No one's paying taxes? Is that what you're saying, Michael?
I'm not sure if any people are paying taxes, but a vast majority of people get paid under the table because companies do not want to pay taxes. And let me tell you, 3 years ago, for sure, UCOS had two sets of accounting books, one for the state and one for the internal use.
This is UCOS, the big oil company. How do you know?
How do I know? It's because I know some people indirectly who used to, or maybe they still work for UCOS. But, you know, I heard things.
So there's a question of who's chipping in here and who's not. Fiona Hill, how about it? Is it a general problem? Does it retard Russia's political development? And are oligarchs paying their fair share?
Well, it's certainly the case that there's been persistent problems in tax collection in Russia. The government has really tried to tackle this in actually some fairly sensible ways by creating a flat tax in the hope that people would pay more by declaring tax amnesties. And I'm sure that Marshall and Anders can talk to this more. But it is also the case that there is a general attitude that the big companies like UCOS, generally perceived attitude, are not paying. And in fact, there's been talk in Moscow, in fact, in government circles for some time now, certainly at least the last couple of years, of increasing collection from the major oil industries, in fact, precisely to stimulate growth in other manufacturing sectors. There's been several reports coming out of some of the institutes about this, precisely because of the desperation that we've talked about already of really stimulating production in the sectors outside the energy and commodities. So I think given the size of UCOS, given the size clearly of the assets and the profits that this sector is turning over, it's a very tempting target. And whether there's actually any truth in the matter that UCOS still maintains two books, one internally and one for the tax police, I think is almost in some respects irrelevant, because I think there is, again, what Marshall was pointing out, this kind of nationalist sentiment about let's make them pay and let's, in fact, take as much of these revenues as we can. And, I mean, this is one way, indeed, if you look actually at the purported claims against Hodorkovsky right now, many of them are monetarized. It's saying, you know, he hasn't paid this amount in back taxes, he hasn't paid this amount and that amount. If you add all of this up, it comes to something like $1 billion.
So light the torches and let's go get the
guy. Russian budget.
I want to explain this question.
Anders, yes, please.
In Russia today, the total tax revenues are about 35% of GDP. The U.S. tax revenues are about 30% of GDP. Russia collects much more taxes than the U.S.
And how do they do it? Does everyone chip in, or how do they get it?
And you have, as Fiona mentioned, a 13% flat tax. The problem that Michael mentioned here, it is the payroll tax, which has come down from over 40% to now an average of 30%. It's aggressive, as in the U.S., and the government intends to lower it to 25% in 2 years' time, exactly for the reason that Michael said. But tax revenues have been going up, and the general discussion in Moscow today on economic policy is that the government redistributes too much, and it redistributes inefficiently, so that it's better to lower taxes. From next year, the value-added tax on all goods and services falls from 20 to 18%. The sales tax of 5% is being abolished next year. So I fully agree that taxes have to come down. But this is underway, and ever less is being paid under the table. Mm-hmm. With regard to the UCOS affair now.
The accounts of the big oil company, yeah.
Yeah, there is an attack against Hodorkovsky and UCOS for having avoided taxes.
So you see the charges as legitimate when they say he was arrested for tax evasion, so we had to pick him up?
I'm going to tell you that they are not legitimate because they used tax avoidance schemes that have been widely used and have been judged legal in court. So people were really scared because these were obvious loopholes in the law that Khodorkovsky and Yukos used, and this is in the old tax legislation.
So everybody was. I want to turn this conversation to a bit of a broader stage, if I may. I'm reading here again from Bruce Jackson's piece in the Washington Post. He talks about an increasingly czarist world in Russia today, and not just in the suppression of democracy, not just in what he characterizes as a failure to impose rule of law, but increasingly aggressive military and extrajudicial actions in old members of the Soviet Union, in the Ukraine, Moldova, South Caucasus, in Chechnya, Russian meddling in elections in Azerbaijan, in Georgia, influence peddling in Moldova, this gumboat standoff with the Ukraine last week. He says, in effect, that there's more than just an internal domestic or political problem here, that the old Soviet empire is in some degree being revived. Marshall Goldman, do you see that outline?
I'm afraid I do. Just extra legal methods. There's raiding the lawyer for Khodorkovsky's home, stealing the records. Raiding even more scandalous in my mind. The offices of Yabloko, one of the opposition parties, taking their records, taking their raiding an orphanage, which Yukos had helped fund on the pretext that they were hiding records in the orphanage because nobody would look there, and also taking their computer. Just a whole series of things and using the masked gunman in the process to raid the orphanage. I mean, that's just typical.
But those are all domestic. Are you saying that style of government action is extending out back to the old neighbors, back to the old empire?
Well, certainly some people feel that. The people in Georgia feel that, where there have been clear efforts to try to rein them in and do something with Shevardnadze. Putin has also tried to do something more to bring back some of the old members of the USSR, except for the Baltic states, by creating an economic entity. It's not so far gone very far. They've tried to do something more with Belarus, but that's fortunately not worked out too well because Lukashenko, the head of Belarus, is worse than anything we've seen since the old Soviet days. But Putin clearly, when he was at Columbia University, just as it's a domestic issue again, but he was at Columbia University on this recent trip. He was asked by a student, how can you defend stamping out freedom of the press? He says, I didn't stamp it out. It never existed. And also making these other things with their neighbors. The neighbors do feel frightened in a way they weren't before.
So Fiona Hill, do we have a kind of, thinly veiled Stalin reemerging here? Or is that just over the top?
Well, I think Stalin's going a bit far, but certainly what Marshall is describing and what you laid out in framing this question is of some considerable concern. I think, however, that the methods have certainly changed. In the early 1990s, we were very concerned about Russia's meddling in what Russia was then referring to as the near abroad, in other words, in the other former republics of the Soviet Union,
yes,
including in the Baltic states and in the Caucasus. We saw many incidences in which Russia was really stirring up conflict, especially in the Caucasus. There was a lot of agitation on behalf of ethnic Russians in many of these republics. And, of course, we have seen many incidences, not just in course of Russia's decision to invade Chechnya, which, of course, is part of Russian territory, but certainly the kind of use of heavy-handed schemes turning off gas and electricity to neighbors in terms of expressing displeasure with certain policies that were taken. But we're seeing a very different approach now. In many respects, what Russia is able to do is to exploit the weakness of other states nearby, and the fact that, again, getting back to the energy issue, that almost all of Russia's neighbours, without any exceptions, including the Baltic states, are still dependent on Russia for both natural gas supplies for heating and power generation and for electricity.
So is the United States going to wake up one day and be looking again at a kind of de facto Soviet Union?
Well, many of the people who are heavily involved in the energy industry now, including Anatoly Chubais, who is the head of the Unified Energy Systems, the main electricity producer, have talked of a kind of so-called liberal empire, which in fact is just the restoration of these old ties, and particularly in energy, electricity and gas distribution mm-hmm. systems mm-hmm. that were centralized in the Soviet period, and restoring them again with Russia at the helm.
Liberal now, empire, but we don't see democracy really flourishing there. I'm not sure what's liberal about it.
Well, I mean, Chubais, would say that it can be liberal. I mean, not everybody is saying here that this is a return to Stalinist methods of people disappearing in the night, though, of course, we should have some concern about Hodorkovsky being pulled off the plane in the way that he was done with masked men and people heavily armed. But there is certainly a difference of approach in many of these actions.
But he himself, actually, Chubais, was very upset with what happened to Khodorkovsky and is trying to rally some of the business community to do this, which, as Fiona, I think, pointed out earlier, is not particularly appealing to the general public. I think the general public is quite happy with what's going on, which indeed is a form of populism that could indeed continue this way.
Taking down the rich guy. Tatiana's calling from Boston. Hi, Tatiana. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. And it's a pleasure to be on the program mm-hmm. with Marshall and Ms. Hill and Professor Lund. And Marshall probably recognized me already. I'm related to Andrei Sakharov, the late Andrei Sakharov. And I may be holding a very extreme view in some opinion, but it seems to me, there is no doubt in my mind that what is going on in Russia in the last several years is something that you have just described in an excellent quote of, what is it, Mr. Jacobs? Scathing summary of what's going on in Russia.
That's Bruce Jackson with the Project on Transitional Democracies.
Sorry,
you
yes.
agree with him? You see a kind of restoration?
I do agree with that, and I know very little time is left, but I just wanted to say that. Why don't we see any, and that's the so-called war with corruption and antitrust, so to speak, policies of Putin's administration. Why don't we see any of those who have privatized immensely in the first years of perestroika and immediately after the collapse of the Soviet Union? Why do we not see all those high echelons of party, of a communist party, people?
See them what, Tatiana? Why don't we see them what?
Why don't we see them being chased like most of the Khodorkovsky or Berezovsky or Gusinsky?
Right.
I think because there is a very good reason behind that. And, you know, I really don't want to take my time by my speculation.
We've got it, and we're short on time, but we thank you for your call, but a very selective kind of targeting here. We're almost out of time. But Fiona Hill, how might the United States, how might the West be bringing a positive pressure on this whole scene? Does it have any influence?
Well, there certainly is some influence. When you look at the energy sector, the only way that Russia makes revenues is, in fact, by exporting. And we right now, the U.S. and Russia are in the middle of a strategic energy dialogue. The Russian state, not just Yukos and the other companies, has expressed interest in selling more oil to the United States and breaking into the U.S. market. Of course, there's a lot of difficulties involved with this. It would require a lot of investment in infrastructure. The U.S., in many respects, has something that Russia wants. And the U.S. can certainly make it clear that if we're going to proceed in these kinds of dialogues, that if, in fact, Russia and the United States are going to continue to engage, then Russia needs to clean up its act. And that this kind of behavior, this selective targeting, Tatiana's absolutely right, it is selective targeting, isn't exactly conducive to any sphere of interaction between Russia and the United States.
Well, we will
if
be
I
watching.
May.
Anders Esselm, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. We'll have to pick it up again. But thank you so much for joining us. It's been great having you tonight. And Fiona Hill in Washington as well, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Marshall Goldman in Cambridge, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Special thanks tonight to Robert Frazier in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.